Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Marla Zink of the Washington Appellate Project, and I'm here on behalf of the juvenile appellant, who I'll refer to as Parrish. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Very well.
Thank you. This Court should reverse Parrish's conviction because the trial court misallocated the burden of who bore the burden to prove that whether Parrish was competent to stand trial. And there's two paths that the Court can use to get there. They can be intertwined or looked at separately, and both are supported and in harmony with the Coley case out of Division III, so I'll discuss those in turn. The first path is a more narrow one based on the facts of this case and actually using the state's argument in response. And the state argues that the burden should be placed on whoever the movement is because there is a presumption of competency. And as discussed in the reply brief, Parrish disagrees with that test, but let's look at the facts of this case. And here we have, first of all, at the clerk's papers, page 13, and at RP 106, what the court said it was considering was whether Parrish remained incompetent, and that's based off of his 2009 evaluation in a different case, we would presume. And so here the court had already overcome the presumption of competency. And under the state's theory, that would mean that it would be their burden to prove competency. Furthermore, at clerk's papers page 15, which are the findings of fact from the competency determination, it sets forth that it was a state's motion to determine competency. So again, under the state's theory, the movement bears the burden, the state was the movement here, it should bear the burden, and it was misallocated by the trial court. Now, this comports with Coley because in Coley they were dealing with a restoration of competency. The presumption of competency had already dissipated in that case. The same would be true here under, as set forth in the court's ruling at CP 13 and RP 106. Now, the other path that the court could take to get there, which could be used to bolster that or could be used separately, is that the defendant should never be saddled with that burden and it should always be on the state. And that's based on a statutory interpretation as bolstered by case law and policy. The legislative analysis here shows that Washington State is very protective of a defendant in these competency determinations. Subsection 1077050, as the Supreme Court has found in several cases and as stated in Coley, is more protective of a defendant here than in federal cases. Section 0.020 also provides a lot of protections for the defendant. He's entitled to counsel during these proceedings.
The specific statute that is at issue here is silent, though, on the burden of proof.
That's correct. And I should say that that's why we're looking to the statutory sections as a whole, to 10.77 as a whole, as a chapter, and to the legislative intent there. Now, the legislature
often... Why don't we just look at the words of the statute, and if it requires the trial court to find something, then the burden of persuasion is on the proponent of that issue being found.
Well, and again, in this case, then that would be the state here, and the court misallocated it, and it should be remanded for a new trial on that issue.
Do you agree with me that
the problem I have with that?
We're looking at a statute that, and it requires a trial court to find something. Then that assumes that if the evidence is in a state of equipoise, which usually only happens because a judge doesn't have the gumption to determine that something's more strong than the other, but if it's in a state of equipoise, then the judge could not find it.
I would agree with that, but I think that's different than the question here, so let me explain that. So we are looking at a very narrow circumstance where this is going to be an issue, because if there is a presumption of competency, we don't disagree with that, and if there is exact equipoise, if it's 50-50, the court can't determine whether there is a showing of incompetency, then the presumption would be competency. But that doesn't dictate who...
Well, is that how it works? Is it after the evidence, if it's an equipoise, or is the presumption of competency something that applies at the beginning of the hearing and is part of the weighing of the evidence? And well, so therefore would be part of the evidence being in equipoise.
That's correct that it would apply at the beginning of the proceedings, and under 10.77060, the court needs to have a reason to doubt competency in order to order an evaluation and to get us to 0.084. And here there was a reason to doubt, and therefore an order was issued for a competency evaluation, and the procedures of 0.060 were followed, which puts us, in my opinion, at .084, the 10.77084, at which point the court has the evaluation before it and is determining competency. In addition, the reasons we don't want to place this on the burden on the defendant here is that the defendant has an absolute fundamental right not to be tried while incompetent. And when you're talking about narrow cases where you're dealing with a preponderance of the evidence standard, the rare cases where it's going to be a very close call, the chance of trying a defendant who might be incompetent or placing the burden on a defendant that might be incompetent to prove his
incompetency. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court disagrees with you on that. In California v. Medina, they address that very question.
Sure.
And they say that allocating the burden of proof to the defendant is not at variance with the fundamental right not to be tried when you're incompetent. So I understand that this keeps trying to get bootstrapped in. I understand that Judge Sweeney did it in the Coley case, but I don't think that it's consistent with Medina. It's clear that the allocation of the burden of proof is a separate question and that it's not fundamental.
Well, I would
because
disagree.
Coley, because Medina says so.
Well, what Medina
you're
says.
You're disagreeing with Justice Kennedy if you're disagreeing with that proposition.
I'm not disagreeing with Justice Kennedy. I think there's a distinction here. What Medina says is that under the federal constitutional law, it is the states can choose to place the burden elsewhere, but it is not a violation of federal due process to place the burden up to a preponderance of the evidence only on the defendant to prove competency, to prove incompetency in the first instance. But what this court is looking at is our statute and our laws, and Wickland and Hedrick say that we are more protective.
If you're saying there's a statutory right, I don't know that I'm disagreeing with you, but a statutory right doesn't make it a fundamental right. That's where Coley goes off the rails, finding it a structural error.
Well, what Hedrick actually said was that failure to comply with the procedures set forth in 10.
Hedrick's wrong when it says that, because that's also inconsistent with Medina.
Well,
the Washington legislature can't create fundamental due process rights under the federal Constitution. It doesn't have that power. It can create statutory obligations on the trial court.
And if I can just have a moment to respond
yes.
to that. The state Supreme Court can interpret the statutory procedures as being necessary to fulfill our state constitutional obligations, and I think that that's the way that I would interpret Hedrick.
There's no separate due process clause analysis under the state constitution, so Hedrick goes up on the rocks there also.
Okay, well.
You have your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. Samantha Kanner on behalf of Respondent State of Washington. Because a person is presumed competent, a party challenging the presumption of competence must prove incompetence by a preponderance of the evidence.
Well, we understand that from your brief, but that's not the only presumption that exists in our world. So let's talk about Coley and how that might affect the analysis here.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Here, we're in the exact opposite position as Coley was in. And so the state's position in this case is entirely consistent with Division III's holding in Coley, which is that once a defendant is found incompetent by a court, then the presumption shifts to the proponent of competence. So it's not necessarily that the state or the defense, it's the proponent of whatever the opposite of the operative presumption is. And in this case, there had been no competency determination with regard to Mr. Tate in this case.
Well, why do we draw an artificial line between cases? If there is a court determination that someone is incompetent, why should there be any difference whether that's in this particular proceeding or a previous proceeding?
Well, I would note in this case, Tate's counsel, and Tate did not make that finding part of the record in this case. There is actually no court order indicating Mr. Tate was incompetent. There was some testimony from Dr. Hendrickson at the hearing that 2 years ago Mr. Tate had been found incompetent and that he had been medicated. But a two-year-ago finding is not necessarily relevant to a current case.
Well, why not? If there's a presumption, there's a presumption.
Right, but in each case, a person is presumed competent. If it were...
I understand your point, but why do we draw an artificial line by case? If someone is incompetent, they're incompetent. They should be presumed incompetent, right?
Yes.
Okay.
In this case, that was not part of the record. So if defense were making that argument, we might be in a different position. However, defense never made that argument at the trial court level, and they haven't made that argument on appeal. They did not make Mr. Tate's incompetency finding from the previous hearings a part of the record in this case.
Are you contesting that he was found incompetent previously?
No, it was a part of the testimony from Dr. Hendrickson that he had been found incompetent previously. There wasn't very much testimony, frankly, about that, which was somewhat surprising, but it was 2 years prior to the competency issue in this case, and so it's not properly before this court, Your Honor.
Okay, well, let me ask you a different question. Let's assume that we disagree with you regarding the allocation of the burden of proof, and we believe that it should have been the state's burden.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't argued that error is harmless in any way. So the question is, what remedy is to be given in this case?
Well, in this case, the remedy would be remand for a retrospective competency determination.
And what would the trial court consider in a retrospective competency determination?
The trial court would reconsider all of the testimony and evidence that was provided at the competency hearing, and could also, in this case, because Mr. Tate testified at trial, they could also consider his trial testimony in determining, and his behavior, I guess, observations during trial as to his competency.
And if the trial court determines that it could not make a new competency determination, what then?
If the trial court were to say we can't make a retrospective competency determination, the court would have to overturn the conviction, order a new competency evaluation, have a new competency hearing, determine the issue of competence or incompetence, and retry the case.
Okay.
But actually, it wouldn't be retried in juvenile court. It would go to adult court, since juvenile court lost jurisdiction in this case back in 2011. So if the court were to determine that the presumption was improper, or the burden was improperly put in this case, I think it's very clear from this record, however, that Judge Trickey would be able to make a competency determination. There was virtually no evidence presented supporting a finding of incompetence in this case. But the result is not to overturn the conviction. It's simply to remand to the trial court. But we don't have to get there, Your Honor, because here Division 3 has explained that the statutory language supports the state's proposition. Now, while Section 060 of Chapter 1077 is silent as to who has the burden, if you look to both Section 084 and 086, both of those sections, the language supports the state's proposition, which is that there has to be a finding of incompetency. In Section 0841A, the legislature stated, if at any time during the pendency of an action and prior to judgment, the court finds, following a report as provided in 1077-060, a defendant is incompetent, and then it goes on to say it should order stay of the proceedings. The court in that scenario the legislature was presuming that a person would start off as being competent, and the court would have to make a finding of incompetence. That supports the state's interpretation.
Again, within a particular proceeding.
Correct, Your Honor. And then 068 or 086, Section 3 says it even more plainly. Now, this is the statute talking about commitment for restoration. However, we have to read the chapter as a whole, as Ms. Zink noted in her opening remarks. And the first sentence says, in Section 3, if the court finds by a preponderance of the evidence that a defendant charged with a felony is incompetent, the court shall have the option of, and it talks about extending commitment. So clearly the court, or the legislature, was operating under the longstanding common rule presumption of competence, that a person starts off competent and must be found incompetent. Now, Ms. Zink talked about the clerk's papers in this case, and I want to point the court to clerk's papers page 6, 7, and 8, which is the order to examine the respondent for competency that was signed by Judge Trickey before the contested competency hearing happened. Nowhere in that document is there any finding of competency or incompetency. Rather, Judge Trickey simply was saying there is a reason to doubt Mr. Tate's competency, so I am going to order an evaluation. That in and of itself, it's suggested in Tate's reply brief that somehow changes the presumption. It does not. All it says is there is a reason to doubt. It could be a hearsay reason. It could be a third-party reason. There is no opportunity to rebut that evidence. There's no opportunity for hearing at that time. merely raising competency does not change the presumption of competency.
It's my understanding, as a practical matter, that it doesn't take much to raise the issue of competency, and that there's no sworn testimony. Counsel or the prosecutor can have a conversation and observe the defendant, and the court can engage in that as well. And so there's no sworn testimony or any evidentiary proceeding or any formal proceeding, and that threshold is just a reason to doubt. So as I understand it, defense counsel is arguing that somehow shifts the burden.
Right. And that
is there any case that supports that notion?
No, Your Honor, absolutely none, because it is such a low threshold. In fact, somebody's cousin could come in and say, you know, I know my cousin had mental problems in the past, and I'm not sure he understands. And the court should say, would normally say, okay, I'm finding there's a reason to doubt so-and-so's competency. I'm ordering an evaluation. That's all that is required at that point. There's no finding that a person is incompetent at that point, and the operative presumption, therefore, does not change. Coley is entirely consistent with that, because in Coley, the defendant had already been found incompetent, and so Coley, the Division III explains that the burden had shifted to the state, and so the incorrect burden was applied in Coley. But Judge Dwyer is correct in that it's not a due process. It's not a due process issue. Medina explains clearly it's not an issue of due process. So if there is an error, it is a statutory error, not a constitutional one. If the court doesn't have any further questions, because Tate was presumed competent, this court should hold that the trial court properly placed the burden of proof on Tate and should affirm his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Moving first to the remedy, I would just point out that a retrospective determination is strongly disfavored under U.S. case law. I'd urge the court not to do that, but just to remand for a new trial. But if the court is inclined to remand for a retrospective determination, I'd ask that it at least phrase it so that the trial court make a determination in the first instance of whether it is even capable of making that retrospective determination rather than ordering it that it be done. Because it really should be in the discretion of the trial court as to whether it's capable of doing that based on the record at the time.
Did trial counsel for Mr. Tate argue at the time when the issue of the burden of proof was first raised, did trial counsel rely on the expert's testimony about a prior competency determination?
Yes, I believe that counsel did. Certainly it was discussed, and it was discussed during cross-examination as well as at the burden stage as to the medication that my client was on at the time of the 2009 evaluation that was brought out in cross-examination with the expert. That was on the record before the court, and in fact, I would disagree with the state in terms of the record and the findings of facts and conclusions of law. The court mentions the 2009 evaluation, so that's a finding that we haven't challenged, and that's at CP 16. In the record at RP 75, there's an extensive discussion with the expert about the 2009 evaluation, and again, looking at RP 106 and CP 13, clerk's papers page 13, the court was clearly starting from the point that the defendant was incompetent. The presumption had been overcome, whether it was based on the 2009 exam or this reason to doubt. In the court's mind, that presumption had already been overcome.
Is the presumption of competency a statutory provision?
I do believe.
From whence does it come?
Let me just double check that, if you don't mind. But no, I don't believe that it is in the statutory provision. It's a common law doctrine and a constitutional law doctrine.
So Judge Cox has been asking questions, the thrust of which has been in some areas of the law, if someone is found to be incompetent, that remains the state until in that action or a different action a court finds differently. Does that apply to this? If there's a finding of incompetence in a discrete case, does that rebut the common law presumption of competence such that if a new case is commenced, that presumption no longer applies?
Well, I believe under Coley it would.
Coley was within the same case, though.
Right, but its holdings are that when there's and its reasoning is that when there's a finding of incompetence, until there's a restoration of that competency, so a finding by a court that there is competency, then the presumption would be that that incompetency remains. And the statute is structured that way as well. Again, that would indicate within a case, but there's no reason that couldn't be applied across the cases. And this obviously was the same defendant. We're not talking about, different people. So thank you, Your Honors. We would ask that you reverse and remand for